Welcome to Ageless by Rescue. This podcast is devoted to exploring the science of rejuvenation, uncovering the most trusted experts, the must-have products, innovations, and technology in the field of vitality, aesthetics, new beauty, and cosmetic enhancement. I'm Baha Etmanen, the founder and editor of Ageless by Rescue. Ageless by Rescue gives you unprecedented access to international and Australian experts and visionaries.
Hi, it's Miranda Kerr here on Ageless by Rescue podcast.
Hi, this is Martha Kay and you are on Ageless by Rescue podcast.
I'm Trini Woodall. I mean, I feel I'm being interviewed by the sexiest woman in the world.
Welcome to today's episode, where I am joined by Dr. Frank Lin, a specialist plastic surgeon and the founder of Eastern Plastic Surgery and EST Clinic in Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Lin specializes in facial aesthetic surgery and treatments with a particular focus on treatment of Asian patients. As a member of the board of the Australasian Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, ASAPS, and the International Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, ISAPS, and an adjunct senior lecturer at Monash University, Dr. Frank Lin brings a wealth of knowledge to today's discussion. Today, Dr. Lin will provide insightful commentary on how race and cultural heritage shape beauty standards and surgical choices across different Asian communities. We will explore various aspects of cosmetic treatments, particularly focusing on Asian demographics. From the growing trend of non-surgical procedures and the influence of social media and celebrities to the specific nuances of surgeries like Asian blepharoplasty and rhinoplasty, Dr. Lin's expertise will guide us through the evolution of aesthetic medicine. We'll also discuss how age and different age groups approach cosmetic enhancements with revealing statistics from recent studies and how these treatments are perceived differently in East and Southeast Asia. Additionally, Dr. Lin sheds light on South Korea's role as a powerhouse in the cosmetic surgery export industry and what the latest trends in 2024 suggest about the future of cosmetic and regenerative treatments. Dr. Frank Lin, I am so thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome to Ageless by Rescue.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Baha. This has been a long time coming and it's a pleasure to be here.
Do you know, it's such a great conversation. I feel like on the, you know, eve of NSS, the Non-Surgical Symposium, of which you are on the Scientific Advisory Committee, having a conversation about how race and cultural heritage impacts surgery trends and procedures is a really important conversation to have at this time.
Yeah, 100%. We, you know, the having a more, I suppose, a diverse, ethnically focused practice has always been something I've done. So, and because I've done it for so long, it's become the norm. But we often forget that Australia is really, really diverse for the population that we have. And, you know, we get patients from all over the world, not just in Asia, but other parts of the world as well. So it is a really important topic, and it's not just a topic confined to surgery per se. I mean, surgeons exist in a bigger landscape, and we're all part of that conversation. So it is a very relevant conversation for not just surgeons, but also cosmetic physicians, dentists, dermatologists, nurses, and dermal clinicians, and every part of the industry.
And I think having that cultural sensitivity and racial sensitivity when you are in this industry is becoming more and more important. I think, you know, 10 years ago, there was always the talk of the golden ratio, which is really a cookie cutter approach. It's not an inclusive approach. It's kind of saying that there is one facial ideal or one body ideal. And that's not the case at all, because each culture, each race has its own unique features and also its unique desires and aspirations. And when I was preparing for this podcast and in conversation with you, it became really apparent that you can't even put Asian into this kind of pan topic. There are absolutely subcategories and huge differences within Asian cultures and different drivers and different aspirations for an aesthetic outcome. So I think with that in mind, it'd be wonderful to start with How do cultural differences impact the decision making for cosmetic treatments? Let's start there.
Yeah, okay. Look, I think it has a huge impact on decision making, and not just the decision to see someone to have a consultation about having something done, but also in terms of treatment planning, how you communicate with this patient, you know, at the initial consultation, so before the procedure. Obviously, how you manage the different sort of, I guess, anatomical differences, both in terms of the bony structure, the soft tissue and the skin, but also how you deal with the aftercare of whatever procedure it is that you're offering. Because something simple as, you know, how well the patient scars or how they scar is makes such a huge impact on the overall outcome. I think that the one big difference that I've seen over the last 10 years is that Asian patients traditionally have a really strong preference for a non-surgical procedures
for
versus
non-surgical.
A non-surgical. Yeah. So if we look at the same age group of patients, sort of age-matched Asian patient versus a Caucasian patient, there's more likely that they'll opt for something that's non-surgical. And I think that's the first guide to a conversation with an Asian patient. They're usually more accepting of non-surgical treatments, and they're usually more knowledgeable. And that's probably a generalization that, you know, knowledgeable patients exist in every ethnic culture, but they often have a stronger baseline understanding of what are some of the non-surgical, the modalities that we might be having a conversation about.
I would tend to agree with that statement, because one of the things that I've noticed from my audience, and I have actually a very large and engaged Asian audience from lots of different subcultures and countries and backgrounds. And the thing that is always fascinating to me is that they're very brand aware. So if they're talking about a technology, they know the brand, they know the series. So if it's an injectable, they know it by brand name. They know what year this technology came out. They know which version and iteration they're interested in. And I don't know whether it's because in other countries you can advertise by brand name, by, and so when they do the research, and they are heavily brand-driven cultures anyway, they know brand names. But I don't find that Australian readers and consumers have that. And I always think Ageless is a bridge to that. It's helping consumers understand what we know behind the velvet ropes of the industry. And that's
100%. Yeah. No, I couldn't agree with that more. Look, I think every culture, there are people who are going to be more brand conscious than others. But in particular, East Asian cultures, they're incredibly brand sensitive. You know, if it's a handbag, it has to be a, you know, it's this Hermes handbag, and people invest a lot of time and effort to try and obtain this bag. And, you know, for men, I suppose it's a bag, it you know, it's got space to put your stuff in it. And, but you couldn't be, you know, you're dead on with that one, because certainly that translates into aesthetics, not just in terms of devices, but also the brand name of the specific products, you know, and people delve into the names, the eponymous names of the techniques that you might use. You know, they come and see you for your eyelids and say, oh, do you use this particular method? So yeah, it is a very knowledgeable group of patients. And I think playing into that is the fact that this sort of, there's a lot more cultural acceptance of treatments. So, you know, Australia, it's a, you know, we very much promote, you know, we're into fitness, health, a healthy lifestyle, you know, being outdoors and all that sort of stuff. So a lot of the language that we use with aesthetic treatments kind of plays into that. Whereas for a lot of Asian patients that I see, there is absolutely no problem with having, you know, aesthetic treatments, with having injectables or energy devices. And people tend to start at a younger age as well. And if we sort of think of the capital, world capital of aesthetic treatments, aesthetic surgery, it's got to be Seoul in Korea. In that jurisdiction.
And it's almost prestigious to say that a technology is from Korea. So I know when Rejuran launched, which is a biostimulator, and, you know, as soon as everyone knew that it was a Korean technology, that instantly elevated it because, as you said, Seoul is the capital of biotech innovation and aesthetic innovation. So instantly it had this halo effect on the technology.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, amongst Asian patients, there is a certain, there's something different about saying, oh, this thing is from Korea, this technology is from Korea, this doctor has studied in Korea. And sort of, I didn't think that that translated necessarily to non-Asian patients, but clearly it does. But so look, I think that, you know, that permeates throughout the rest of Asia. Definitely Koreans are trendsetters in terms of this industry and a lot of things, a lot of concepts, you know, that we might even mention down the track, perhaps had their roots in Korea or in K-pop or something like that, but they've taken root and the rest of Asia has followed. But so coming to the point, you know, a lot of patients, particularly in Korea and in Asia, are very much
younger patients.
Younger, and they're very much more accepting of that. There really isn't that sense of stigma associated with having an aesthetic treatment, which again is a little bit different to what we're used to here.
I'm Iranian by background. I was born in France and I emigrated to Australia when I was 7, but I am Iranian. And Iran is also a culture that's very, very accepting of aesthetic intervention and surgical intervention. I would say at least one out of two girls in Iran will have rhinoplasty. And I was one of them. I had my first rhinoplasty when I was 17. It was immediately after I finished high school in America. I was waiting to start university over in Queensland. What did I want for my 18th birthday? I wanted a rhinoplasty. So off I went and had my rhinoplasty so that the swelling could settle before O week at university. And so, of course, I had it too early. And then I needed a revision rhinoplasty when I was about 25. And I would love another one now. But in my head, it just wasn't a big deal. And I can tell you, I grew up in Canberra and it's a very conservative town. It was like I'd set myself on fire and was walking through the main street naked. It was so controversial and exotic for a 17-year-old to want rhinoplasty and to just expect that that was totally normal. And so I do have to catch myself because I'm the mother of a young girl and I'm fascinated with aesthetics and I live in this world and it's part of what I do. And a lot of my friends are doctors and surgeons that, you know, it's normal for me. It's culturally normal for me, but Lily's growing up in Australia. So, and it's a much more sensitive topic. And as you said, it's not as culturally accepted to bandy around, you know, invasive procedures or even non-invasive procedures for young men, young women. So it's an interesting one when you talk about cultural sensitivity. Do you think there's differences in patient population seeking aesthetic treatments? You know, when they start much younger, does that mean they get to surgery a lot younger too? If they start with non-aesthetic, non-invasive treatments?
No, look, I don't know that. Look, I think this is a finding. This is something that exists in Asia. And I was just going to say that if you were not born in Iran, but rather you were born in Korea, for example, that first procedure is probably almost certainly going to be blepharoplasty. You know, so eyelid, Asian eyelid or double eyelid surgery. That, you know, we hear about that. You know, we hear about people having that for their 18th birthday or something like that. But it is actually true. It is, you know, upper eyelid surgery is by far the most common surgery that patients have. And that's not to say that that's right or wrong. You know, as you said, these are invasive procedures and they do carry risks. And there are considerations of having it done earlier rather than later. And as you said, you know, if you had these sort of surgery earlier, then, you know, there's a lifetime of, you know, a date of 18, there's no aging at all. And as we get older, you know, there is a higher chance of needing sort of revisional procedures. So that is a conversation that necessarily needs to be had. But they are having their surgery younger. They're more accepting the culturally, the injectables and non-surgical treatments at a younger age. And one of the things that we often fail to look at is that fourth dimension of what happens with time. And, you know, to a greater or lesser extent, we are seeing the aftermath of that because we're getting into you know, maybe the second or third decade of a lot of these patients who have had treatments younger, and they're coming into their 30s and 40s and 50s. And, you know, sometimes we see extremely successful cases of where they've sort of carried that through safely, you know, and they look fresh and bright, even at an older age. But all too often, we're seeing sort of the aftermath of what perhaps could have been done better. And that's one of the things that, certainly speaking to my colleagues, the specialist doctors and the dermatologists and the plastic surgeons in Korea, that's one of the things that they're concerned about, is that all these patients have started very young. And by the time they get into their middle ages, all the problems of puffiness and overvolumization and scar-related issues are something that they're needing to deal with on a day-to-day basis. But there's no doubting that the vast majority of aesthetic treatments in that jurisdiction, in those Asian countries, are performed for younger patients. I mean, I think we've even looking at data from pre-COVID, so this is a few years old now, you know, if we look at the use of injectable treatments in China, for example, about 45% of all of that, those treatments are provided to patients under the age of 25. Now, you sort of have to sit back and think about the enormity of that statistic. You know, if you are not legally able to have treatments until the age of 18, between age 18 and 25, it's only, 7 years, and 45% of all of those treatments are provided to that population of patients. So yes, there is some, you know, those patients are very accepting of these treatments, but here's the flip side of that coin, isn't it? Here's the harm, the potential harm that they can get themselves into. And then between the age of 25 and 35, which is still very, very young, and under the age of 35, you're really only beginning to see the signs and of aging changes. That's another 40%. So 45 plus 40 is 85%. So 85% of all injectable or aesthetic treatments are provided to patients under the age of 35. So in other words, in my age group,
that's a wild statistic.
It is
wild. Imagine if we went around talking about that in Australia. I mean, the TGA is locking down on advertising. APRA made significant changes around laws and the way that, you know, surgical and non-surgical procedures were carried out in Australia back in July last year. And now you have a market, let's call it a market, just outside of Australia, where 80% of the population under 35 are having some kind of aesthetic treatment. That is a huge shift. That's going to filter down. So it must filter down, right?
Yes. I mean, that's not even a Korean statistic. That's a statistic from China. And it's a few years old.
That's what I mean. Yeah. But that's going to trickle down to Australia because, you know, we have a lot of people living here. We have a lot of Asian students coming here. We have a lot of people holidaying here, having health tourism that comes to Australia, I would say. So that's a massive difference to what we have as an Australian statistic.
Yeah. And I think here is, you know, it is contingent upon, you know, there are different pillars that hold up this industry, isn't it? There is the clinicians, there's the regulators, there's patients and so on. It's contingent upon us to understand what is coming, but also to be wary, to be aware of some of the risks that are associated with that. I mean, starting young is, you know, it can be problematic when you get to a certain age, when the cumulative problems can become a...
Yes. Raise your hand. Dr. Lin, I'm going to ask you something. Where does regenerative medicine sit in this conversation? Because another thing that's, you know, coming out of Asia and is exciting is this convergence of regenerative medicine alongside advancements in non-surgical and surgical advancements. And is there a merging that's happening? Is there a greater interest in preventative, regenerative skincare as a modality?
Yeah, I think if you were to ask me what is the one word that will sum up what is to come in the next, you know, 10 or 20 years, it probably is, regenerative would be a very good word to describe that. I mean, classically, it doesn't matter whether it's non-surgical or surgical. When we think aesthetic treatments or aesthetic surgery, you know, it's about, you know, in some ways it's about camouflage. It's about treating the visible signs of what aging has brought to us. But I think regenerative medicine, which is I guess a little bit, always been a little bit more peripheral, is certainly going to be taking center stage. The concept that regenerative medicine or aesthetics will bring will affect every level, non-surgical skincare, non-surgical surgical treatments. It'll filter, it'll merge into where we take aesthetic treatments, because it's no longer about camouflage or dealing with the aftermath or the secondary effects of aging. It's actually dealing with aging in a much more fundamental level, at a more cellular level. And, you know, I think that's always been more peripheral, because we had a very fundamental, very, very sort of basic understanding of that. But as the knowledge of that improves, it will 100% we'll see that merging of those streams of treatments, so that we're already seeing that, because what we're seeing with patients who have had 10 or 20 or 30 years of treatments, we're seeing cumulative effects of trying to solve all the problems by filling, you know, the conceptually, you know,
was the goal. Everyone wanted 100%. volume.
Oh, that's right. Well, that's the one thing we kind of had, wasn't it? It was sort of the first real tool other than,
freezing or volumizing.
Well, that's right. Yeah. I'll try to think of a word that I could say. Freezing is a great word.
freezing or volumizing.
Yeah, so we could either do one of those two things, and we're trying to deal with all the elements of aging, both at a basic cellular level, but also in terms of appearance, with those two tools. What did you expect, you know, looking at it now with 2020 vision? So people are much, much more sort of wary or careful about the concept of volume nowadays. I mean, I think undoubtedly volume will still play a role. It always will have a role, because one of the hallmarks of aging is volume depletion, you know, is bony resorption. If you talk to plastic surgeons, everything starts off at the bone, at the bony level. So one of the problems is that you get bony resorption. You do lose volume in those deep fat pockets in those planes of the anatomy. So volume is always going to be part of that regenerative or rejuvenation, that journey, but it's certainly not the only thing.
I also think, if I may, one of the things is that trend will dictate what is considered aesthetically beautiful, and then it will filter down to what treatment is the treatment du jour. So, for example, I think that Ozempic face is going to be a real, real thing. And we might get to a phase where we accept it. So there would be that many people that are taking weight loss drugs, and there are that many people who've had a collapse of volume in their face or sagginess of skin in their body, that we become a little bit more forgiving rather than trying to scaffold that and repair that, as an example. Or the other way is that in reaction to a big cultural shift, a big health shift of massive and rapid weight loss, we'll put a youthful full face really on a pedestal. So you'll want an ultra skinny body, but a super full youthful face. And I think those things then ripple onto what society as a whole considers beautiful and attractive. And then a whole new trend in aesthetics is born. Is that what you see as a surgeon?
Okay, so I think there's there's many concepts in that. So the two things I'd like to mention. First of all, I think you're talking about a phenomenon called perception drift, which is well studied and well established. So in
Glad
fact, there were some very very interesting studies on that. You know, and this sort of goes to the clearest example of that is the size of lips. So if you ask normal people what is an attractive size lip, and then they'll select that size. And then if you then bombard them or brainwash them with pictures of very large lips, then their perception will shift very quickly. And we see this in plastic surgery all the time. You know, as soon as the treatment is done, as soon as the augmentation is done, suddenly the, you know, this size breast is normal. And it's the natural tendency to say, oh, you know, if slightly larger is better, even larger is even better, which is obviously not true. So perception drift is the first thing. The second thing is, and coming back to the point of how Asian sort of cultural influences, you know, the puff, not so much puffiness, but a smooth contour and a well-volumed face has always been really prized in Asian baby aesthetics. Face. Yeah, it's really prized in Asian aesthetics. And we see that in, you know, in social media every day. You see it in K-pop stars, you see it in, you know,
in cartoons.
Like Pink.
But even in cartoons, you see that.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at any Glitter Force or any of those things, there is a very much an idealized baby face. It's got a fullness to it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, you know, that was always prized in Asian aesthetics. You know, the smooth facial contour has always been more sought after than something that has a lot of highlights and shadows and so on. So, you know, when we treat Asian mid-faces, for example, the volume never goes onto the side because East Asian facial structure has an over-representation of width relative to vertical height. So a lot of what we're doing there is to try and certainly not adding more width, but try to mitigate those peaks and troughs in the facial contour, so it's nice and smooth. And, you know, that's a conversation I have with patients on a daily basis, how to treat or improve their facial contour. So I think Asian patients have always prized that sort of slightly, you wouldn't say the word puffy, but you would say a well-volumed sort of smooth facial contour. So I kind of have a feeling that the Ozempic face is not going to be something that takes off in Asia. I think people will be very wary of that, and they'll probably, if anything, the whole esteemed bun face, or what we call a mantou脸, which is a trending term to describe an over volume face, is
esteemed bun face.
Esteemed bun mantou is like,
I know, I could immediately visualize what they're trying to say with that.
Yeah, so particularly great. When people animate, when they smile, they go, oh gee, there's a couple of steam buns on your mid face. So that sort of thing is very much, you know, people are really wary of that. So I think perhaps Ozempic, you know, for now anyway, might be something that's confined to sort of Western cultures.
Let me ask you about the impact of social media and celebrity culture in Asian aesthetics and surgical demands and trends. Where does it filter from? Like, you know, what is the funnel, so to speak, for an Asian population?
Oh, I think you'll probably find that in every country, in every jurisdiction in Asia, they've got their own unique social media. So, you know, because we service a large number of East Asian or Chinese patients, so we focus a lot of our efforts on WeChat. That's one platform, but there are various platforms throughout Asia, and they're quite
unique. Are they influencers? Is it a real life influencer, or is it a celebrity culture that's driving change and driving the aesthetic ideal?
I think it's probably going to be a little bit of both. I mean, I think the celebrity culture is quite unique. Again, if you go to Japan, for example, there are very specific, you know, Japanese sort of icons. And if you go to Korea, which we've sort of said is a bit of a trendsetter, that they'll have theirs. But Asia is a hugely diverse, populous sort of place. And they kind of all influence each other to some extent. And I think we recognize K-pop because they've made it into a lot of the mainstream media in Western countries. But if you were to go to Asia, there's a very unique cultures within each of these jurisdictions that drive or that influence trends and what we think and our concepts or perceptions of what is attractive.
And in terms of skin quality, because I know that that's something you're really passionate about in your practice, and probably more so than any other plastic surgeon that I've ever spoken to, you have invested in and are passionate about good skin and the convergence of, you know, that multimodality. That seems to be really your signature. what skincare trend and what skincare ingredient and what skincare direction are you most excited about? And what are your patients seeking?
I think if we take that to a more fundamental, more basic level, the fact that, I mean, Australian plastic surgeons or cosmetic plastic surgery in Australia is in itself of extremely high standard. If we look globally, perhaps the one thing we don't do so well when we compare ourselves to other countries, particularly countries in Asia, is that we tend to lack that holistic approach, that looking at the entire facet of that patient journey. And both on a clinical level, on a sort of on a commercial level as well, it actually makes sense to incorporate that into our a plastic surgery practice. And that's one of the concepts that we time and time again try and impart onto the trainees or the new surgeons, the new players that come into the industry. To say that, you know, yes, we have a skin clinic. Yes, we use a variety of energy platforms. We look after that before the, not just the during, not just the operative, you know, stitching and, you know, repositioning soft tissue and so, not just the during, but we look after the before and the after aspect of that is been around in Asia for decades. You know, if you want to see what that one-stop shop is in, you've got to visit Asia, you've got to visit Seoul. You can see patients, that whole journey, landing at the airport, getting picked up and taken to the clinic, having that holistic consultation, analysis, everything.
And then, on TikTok,
you know, it's at a different level. And I haven't been there for a number of years now, since pre-COVID, but even it was mind blowing. And, you know, and then the whole send off to the airport and, you know, helping you get your tax back and that sort of stuff. That it's that whole industry in Chinese, called a yitiaoxianfu, which means like it's from beginning to end, essentially. That sort of service with plastic surgery taking pride of place, but as one part of it. And I think you suddenly at the other end get a patient who is much more satisfied with that, rather than say, okay, here's your facelift and you're all done. You haven't had complication. Your scar seems to be healing. See you later. You know, next patient, sort of that sort of concept. Yes, there are we can dissect that out and say, yes, there are skin care concepts in there, you know, the glass face concept that everyone's sort of heard about. But I think that's probably the one thing that I've learned early on that I've tried to put into every part of my aesthetic practice is that skin, which is that the thing that we see, canvas that you work with, if it's of a superior quality, if it's healthier, then you are going to get a better result. You are going to get, and the flip side of that is that it also helps to camouflage some of the problems that, you know, it's not everyone that we can do a perfect result. Sometimes we're seeing patients for revisional work. You know, there's scar tissue in there, and you've just got to be honest with them and say, you know, I don't know that we're going to be able to achieve that goal that you want, but here's a whole lot of other things that's going to help me to get as close to that as possible. And that's the value of having a holistic or investing in skincare before and after the procedure, and putting energy, for example, as part of the aftercare or as part of the maintenance of those patients.
Can you talk to me about, we've talked before, and also offline, we talked about the two most common surgical treatments, the double eyelid surgery and also Asian rhinoplasty. Right. And can you tell me why those are specific to a race and the cultural significance of those two things, what it means to the patient, yeah, and why they're important surgeries for that subset?
Okay, so those are by far the number one and number two aesthetic or cosmetic operations that are done in Asia, hands down. Okay, number one. And that's the same for my practice. Number one is eyes, and number two is nose, number three is breast, probably. And it goes back fundamentally to why people seek these types of surgeries. And one of the things that's always been talked about, but that's wrong, is to say that that's because Asian people want to look more Caucasian, or, you know, they want
to
look.
Yes, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was...
honestly, that could not be further from the truth. And any more than, and I'm actually paraphrasing someone here, I'm pretty sure there was a paper that came out with, you know, Waffles Wu, Stephen Liu, some of the names that we know, talking about trends. And I think it might have been in that paper where they said, you know, for an Asian person to have double eyelid surgery, to say that they want to look more Caucasian, it's the same as saying a Caucasian surgeon who goes to a tanning salon wants to get darker and they want to look more Asianized. That's not true. You know, that they don't want to look more Asianized. There are intrinsic, not so much deficiencies, the differences that we have that ethnically that perhaps a lot of people don't like, and they want to get to have a slightly better version. So they want to still look like an Asian person, but a beautiful Asian person, an Asian person with slightly larger eyes, for example. So having double eyelid surgery is common in Asia because for a lot of East Asians, they intrinsically lack that supratarsal fold, which is a fold of skin, which exists almost universally in Caucasians. So in Australia, in the Western world, there's not even a word, there's no term for a double eyelid, because that supratarsal fold exists in everyone. There's no need to have a special term.
It's not unique.
Whereas in Asia, for a lot of East Asians, they don't have a stable double eyelid fold. And the purpose of that fold is simply to give the impression the eye's bigger, has more depth, is brighter. You know, so that is a feature that is almost universally prized in Asia. And for a lot of patients who don't have that, who were not born with that, they seek that. So it is it's a operation that's been done for decades. But just like a lot of seemingly simple operations, it can be done very badly too. You know, it conceptually is very simple.
And it can really change the face.
100%, because if we look at where we look at on another person's face, we don't tend to focus on, you know, any individual feature of their face. You know, we're not really analyzing the other human being when we communicate with them. The one area where we're more likely to be looking at is their eyes. So it adds to that overall impression, Mark, doesn't it? And just like, you know, anything that's conceptually simple, like making a steak, anyone can make a steak or anyone can make a fried rice or something like that. But sometimes we pay a lot of money to go to someone who makes a really, really good, they do something really, really well. And this is one of the areas where you conceptually simple, but can be done very well or can be done very badly. So that's the sort of an Asian eyelid.
You get reverse travel. You know, you talked before about a lot of people traveling to Korea or hubs where they're very well renowned for treatment. So, for example, a lot of Caucasian people will travel to Turkey for hair transplants. That's an area that's really renowned for it. Or they might go to Thailand for an inexpensive and relatively safe breast augmentation surgery because a lot of hospitals will offer that. Do patients from different parts of Asia travel to Australia for surgery? Is that, first of all, is it possible? And secondly, is that a thing?
It is a thing. Asian patients are reasonably familiar with the whole concept of traveling to obtain a specific service. And classically within Asia, it was all sort of going to Korea to have their surgery. But, you know, have a lot of really good colleagues in Korea, and Korea is no different to any other jurisdiction. There are people who do the surgery really well. There are specialist surgeons, but they also have the same problems that we see everywhere else. Is that they have a lot of players that perhaps are less experienced or less qualified who are also offering the same procedure. And I guess the advice is, you know, it doesn't matter where you're having your surgery, you should always do your homework. You should always ask the right questions. Question the qualification, the experience of the surgeons, whether you're in Australia or anywhere else. So you can get you can get great results, but you can also get very terrible results coming out of, you know, places like Korea.
And very terrible results that happen overseas are very difficult to fix.
I think that's one of the, you know, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, what seemingly might be very well marketed may not be all that. And the key question that people forget to ask when we talk to the surgeon is, what happens if something goes wrong? What are you going to do? Where are you going to fix it? How are you going to fix it? You know, what does it take? And so on and so forth. Everyone goes into consultations with this sort of glowing sort of expectation of this is what I'm going to do. And necessarily a consultation is not complete without a discussion of what happens if things don't go right. And ultimately for those patients, safety is always going to be the first thing. What happens, you know, who's going to fix it? So, you know, I think those concepts are universal, irrespective of where you come from.
For the rhinoplasty treatment, which you said is the number two typical treatment in an Asian culture, as I said, you know, I know that in a Middle Eastern culture, rhinoplasty is number one. It's first and foremost, you almost have it as a rite of passage. But can you explain to me what specifically an Asian rhinoplasty, why it would be different, and what is the end trend or aesthetic goal that it's aspired to?
Yeah. It's almost the opposite, isn't it? In almost every way that we think about rhinoplasty, you know, in perhaps in the Middle East or in Australia, a lot of rhinoplasties that we perform are reductive, refinement. You know, we're trying to reduce, refine, make thinner, and make more delicate. Yeah. You know, certain aspects of the nose. And while some of those concepts still exist, a lot of the here we go again. You know, we're talking about ethnic, you know, areas of ethnic bony weakness. So for a lot of Asian people, the dorsum above the back of the nose lacks height, which is a characteristic, which is normal. You know, it's a characteristic of an East Asian facial skeleton, is that there is a lack of height in that medial maxillary area and in the dorsum of the nose. You know, the nose tend to lack projection. The skin is a little bit thicker at the tip, and the tip lacks projection as well. So a lot of what we do in Asian rhinoplasty is augmentation in nature, is to create height, create projection, and create that balance between a highlight and a shadow. Whereas perhaps in other jurisdictions, it would be more of a reductive in nature. So, and because augmentation, you need to put materials there, it necessarily leads to a conversation about what are we going to use? Are we using prosthesis, and what sort of prosthesis we use? And are we going to use our own tissue? And, you know, this is a whole conversation in itself. But in principle, the idea is almost very different in Asian rhinoplasty. And again, that necessarily leads to people who do more of the augmentation, more used to using materials and using rib cartilage and so on and so forth, versus others who may not be so experienced with that.
I wanted to ask you, when it comes to training and specialization, you know, a specialist plastic surgeon, and this was one of the big things that led the APRA changes last year, is that they wanted the title of surgeon, cosmetic surgeon, to be used appropriately for someone who had the additional training. And so my question is, as a specialist plastic surgeon who specializes in Asian surgeries and Asian patients, do you have additional training, or is that an on-the-job specialization?
No, I think the training program necessarily is very rigorous. And as I said before, the specialist plastic surgery training program in Australia is very well regarded. It's a world-class training program. But because of the breadth of what we deal with in Australia, specialist plastic surgeons, you know, it's normal that our trainees will come out and be fully qualified and have a certain interest in a certain area. And that might be aesthetic surgery. It might be something else. It might be reconstructive microsurgery or burns or something else. But for those of us who have an interest in aesthetic surgery, we might want to take that further by having further study. Now, aesthetic surgery is always been a very important element of our existing training program. And, you know, and I'm involved in the curriculum of the current training program as it is, and it's always been a really important part of that program. But, you know, but quite similarly to patients, to surgeons who might want to specialize in, you know, cleft lip and palate, for example, often those surgeons will go away and do a subspecialty fellowship. And for us, for me, that involved a number of years, you know, overseas and studying with surgeons who do a lot of Asian aesthetic surgery in places like Japan, Korea, Shanghai, Singapore and places like that to gain that additional experience and to bring it to your own patients when you come back. So more and more, we're going to see plastic surgery, people specializing in specific parts of the their practice. And if that area happens to be aesthetic surgery or Asian aesthetic surgery, you know, that is a subspecialty in its own right, in my opinion.
So I guess that leads me to my last question is, how do you choose a surgeon with a specialty, a specialization, a subspecialization? So we already know that you can go and, you know, research a specialist plastic surgeon on the ASAPs. But how do you make sure that those sub-qualifications or those niche qualifications are what you're looking for? Do you have any advice on how to make those inquiries or where to research this?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with what you said, which is the first point you made, which is that if you're seeking cosmetic surgery or aesthetic surgery, make sure it is someone who is a specialist plastic surgeon. You know, it is someone who's been through the AMC accredited training program under the auspices of the Australian Society of Plastic Surgeons and the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons. So that's the first point. The second thing is, I think it comes down to the questions you ask. I mean, yes, we need to look at, you know, the qualifications. We can go on their website and we can go onto the ASAPs or the ASPs website to make sure these are fully qualified members. But also during the consultation, to make sure you ask the questions, you know, and don't be afraid to ask.
We are afraid. You're the surgeon, so I think you forget that, you know, culturally and as a society, people have put plastic surgeons on a pedestal. Mm. And normally we don't have a science background or a medical background. So we don't know what we don't know. Mm. And, you know, as this new kind of era of the super consultation is coming in, which I think is going to be wonderful for patients, by the way, I'm excited for it. I'm wondering if you have any kind of suggestions of how we can kind of overcome our own personal barriers about being embarrassed or reticent to advocate for ourselves in our consultation, to ask those questions, or if there's something we can do pre-consultation that will give us this information.
Yeah, I don't know that there is a special, you know, trick I have up my sleeve, other than the fact that you'll find that most plastic surgeons are pretty approachable. And I think perhaps the way to frame this sort of mindset would be to say that it's actually much better to ask the question before the surgery takes place. Once it's done and you sort of go, oh, was that all right? That it's much harder to delve in to do your homework after it's all done and dusted. You do get the, nowadays, particularly with the new regulation, a lot of, there will be opportunities to speak to the surgeon on more than one occasion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is that consultation process is a way of you getting into the head of the surgeon and also for the surgeon to get into your head, so that what you're expecting and what they're offering you kind of roughly aligns with reality. So I think give the surgeon the best opportunity to try get into your head, so to speak. But at the same time, you should expect that the surgeon gives you the respect and the time that's needed so that you could get into sort of their head as well, just so that you understand everything you need to about that surgeon. And it's only when that consultation kind of balances out and you reach that sort of consensus, is perhaps one word of saying it, that you're going to get that you're going to get that good outcome that you want.
Dr. Lin, we've talked about what's, you know, consistently the most requested surgeries and treatments. Is there anything that's on your radar that you see coming over on the horizon, whether it's kind of a trend forecast or a response to something that's happening culturally or physically to patients, that you think is going to really blow up over the next few years?
I think the on a very conceptual level, I think what you've already mentioned, which is the regenerative medicine, is going to affect every aspect of what we do. You know, I think people are more careful, are more wary of having volume per se, whether that volume comes from a certain injectable or whether that volume comes from fat grafting, for example. You know, I think that will color what people are requesting and what treatments are going to be offered. So there's going to be a lot more effort understanding the role of how certain materials or how some of our autologous products, you know, blood, stem cells, fat, and so on, is that the role those will have on the overall aging process and what we see as being the result of aging. So I guess conceptually, that's probably the trend that things are going, rather than specifically say, well, this is great platform that I think is coming. But I think all of the products and all of the treatments that will be offered, including surgery, will necessarily incorporate some of the concepts that's going to bring to the industry.
And do you see any part of Asia other than Korea fast-tracking their R&D and their innovation hub to respond to the meteoric growth of...
I think perhaps I am biased because a lot of my patients are from China and I'm originally Chinese and I speak Chinese. So I think the, you know, all eyes, you know, necessarily on China at this point. They just have the resources and the sort of the economic power and the
drive.
Population and to drive these innovations. I've heard a lot of talk about, oh, China, you know, Korea is the China in 20 years. I don't know that that's necessarily going to be true anymore. I think a lot of the innovations coming out of there and a lot of the work that I see coming out of the researchers and the surgeons from China will become leaders in their own right. And it's a really exciting space to be in at this point. And certainly I'm not the only one. A lot of pharmaceutical companies, a lot of clinicians are looking to China for, you know, the next 10 to 20 years to see what innovations are that will be coming out of there.
Well, that seems like an exciting prospect. And, you know, we know that they can move fast. As you said, they have the population to back the R&D and moving through technology very, very quickly. Just finally, one of the things that I feel like we touched on, but we didn't go a little bit further. You mentioned breast augmentation being the third area of treatment that's quite popular for an Asian patient base. Is it breast reduction or breast augmentation that you see, or breast lifting, that's the growth area in for that particular procedure?
I think if we look at surgical procedures over the last...
And I'm asking about surgical because obviously you're a specialist.
Appreciate that. So I think if we look at surgical procedures, I think the areas of treatment have largely remained sort of stable across the last 10 or 20 years in Asia. So it's the same areas, but the technique has been refined and our armamentarium of what we can do has improved. Specific to breast, I mean, I think it's less common to see that Asian patients are needing a breast reduction because ethnically patients tend to be slimmer and they tend to not need a breast reduction per se. So augmentation and breast lift is something that we tend to see a lot more of. Perhaps in these areas, there's a lot more patients considering autologous fat grafting rather than the use of prosthesis. But I think that is a very individual conversation. There are some people who are just more able to, who are more suitable for one versus the other. You know, if it's a very, very slim lady, then they may not have enough donor tissue for autologous breast augmentation, and they're more likely to need an implant. So here's where we see implant technology improving over the years. But certainly compared to 10 years ago, we're seeing a lot more patients who are knowledgeable and requesting autologous, using their own tissue, essentially with fat grafting and so on, for breast volume improvement.
Well, I could ask you 1,000 more questions, but I think you'll want to go. It was such a joy and a pleasure to have this conversation with you, Dr. Lynn. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I keep grabbing you at the conferences for 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, but I've had a whole hour with you and I feel very, very lucky. I'm excited to see you speak at the NSS. You're doing something different this year in your contribution to the Non-Surgical Symposium. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. Well, the NSS is a wonderful platform. It's the largest platform for aesthetics, medical aesthetics in Australia. And it is something that has been going for, you know, over 10 years. So my role at the NSS is to be the co-convener of the AFI, which is the Anatomy for Injectors cadaver course. So this
for
year,
the layperson, that means
that is essentially a anatomical dissection course, which plays a really important role in educating and teaching us about human anatomy, facial anatomy, you know, and from a training and education perspective, anatomy remains one of the fundamental sort of pillars of what makes up safe injecting. So I'll be convening that course, and which is the one day before the NSS conference, and that's always held in Brisbane. And this year, in addition to having a cadaver dissection course, we're also incorporating the use of ultrasound. So we've got some really wonderful faculty, and we'll be learning anatomy both from the anatomy lab, but also clinically using this wonderful tool that we're hearing more and more about, which is the ultrasound. So that'll be the AFI course one day before the NSS. And of course, the NSS is on the Gold Coast as before.
Thank you again. That was brilliant. I can't wait to see you at the NSS. And I truly appreciate your time and your insights today.
No, thank you very much, Bahar. This is long overdue and it's a pleasure to be on your show.
It was long overdue. Thank you for making time for me.
Okay, thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, please share and rate this episode. I'd love that. I'm Bahar Etmanan, your host and founder of Ageless by Rescue. For more exclusive content, show transcript, behind-the-scenes video, real people reviews, and extended interviews with experts, I invite you to please follow us at Ageless by Rescue on Instagram, Facebook, and Rescue TV on YouTube. You can also sign up to receive our e-magazine and newsletters, all for free.